promise and more is a thing.
Call the order of the House Committee on Environment and Water. Members, we have a full agenda today. We're going to try to move through the bills posted for public hearing before 4:30, at which time we'll go to work session on 102, 104, and 105. But let's start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 391A. And our my vice chair informs me that the riffraff are here. He says that that means the senators are here. We'll invite them to begin, kick off the testimony here. So Senator Hess and Senator Booker.
It's actually an accurate quote, so I appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're going to let the senior riffraff go first. We still have etiquette over there, Mr. Chair.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, Mark Hass, State Senate District 14. I think you know pretty much what Senate Bill 391 aims to do. Let me just tell you that I've been working on this issue for 6 years, and it started with Al the Alligator in the Beaverton area. Some of you may know that story, but essentially it was someone who bought a cute baby alligator at one point, brought the alligator home, and within a few years, Al the Alligator grew up into a 4.5-foot-long, mean-looking beast. And one day, Al escaped. We think he was headed back to the Everglades or something. And they called the police, and the police didn't know what to do. They alerted the neighborhood to keep your kids and your pets in. And you can imagine the police didn't really know what to do. Nobody's trained in crocodilia treatment. A few days later, they did find Al the Alligator. Unfortunately, he didn't eat any pets or children. And unfortunately, he was not in very good shape. And so you have an animal welfare issue here, but you also have a law enforcement issue. And what do you do with an alligator at that point if you're a local police department? Do you take him to jail? There are no facilities in the metro area that deals with alligators. And I tell you that story because similar stories play out all over the state all the time, and you'll hear that from law enforcement who will testify here today. And that's really what this seeks to do in terms of alligators, primates, and other wild animals that should be just that, left out into the wild. We have been working, I have anyway, through the channels and the evolution of this, and worked into many of the concerns that have been brought to me about this issue, and I think those concerns are incorporated into this bill. So please remember, the bill will not result in anybody having to get rid of their animals. They are all grandfathered in. People who currently own an exotic animal will be able to keep their animal for the rest of its life, but then would be prohibited from replacing it with another. So you'll hear from the Oregon Zoo, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, OMSI, and law enforcement throughout the state that support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12. I, too, have, for my colleagues that have been in the chamber 3 terms like I have, been alongside, generally on the right-hand side of Senator Haas, not on the left-hand side, but alongside Senator Haas. And I come from this from almost a totally different perspective. As most of you know, I've spent over 30 years in the service of the government in various distinct opportunities overseas around the world, and have involved directly in trying to stop the smuggling of exotic animals. If you're not familiar with it, it's a $10 billion industry, most of which comes to the United States. Unfortunately, it's generally the smuggling that comes into the United States is tied to illegal drugs and gangs. I could go through a handful of articles that have been published in the last 6 months that identify various smuggling rings here in the United States, coming out of Colombia, coming out of further portions of Latin America, out of Africa, and unfortunately some tragic incidences happened just at the turn of the year where a handful of park rangers were killed in an operation by rebels in an effort to get exotic animals to smuggle out. Unfortunately, most of them are smuggled out on false end-user certificates and then end up, for the most part, into the United States. And so I take it at a little different angle, having been there and seen the park rangers and seen the soldiers in foreign countries killed by the illegal trade of this. And so I look at it as a regulatory issue, along with Senator Haas. With that, be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Chairman Cannon, I would just want to add two things. It's come to my attention that there may be an amendment considered that would exempt small primates, sometimes called helper monkeys. And I would just point out that the American with Disabilities Act already requires that any person who has a disability as defined by the ADA to possess an assistance animal, which includes a monkey, so long as the monkey is trained to do specific tasks for a disabled person, that is included in that federal law. In addition, I should point out that the recent incident here in Salem at the Riverfront Park, where a capuchin monkey bit a six-year-old girl, was a helper monkey. I also know that you may consider an amendment to exempt small wild cats. And you know, I think that goes against the very point of this bill, that all wild cats, regardless of size, present some safety and animal welfare concerns as long as they're kept in private possession as pets. And Oregon has seen its share of incidents involving small cats. A pet lynx escaped and jumped a six-year-old girl on a six-year-old girl head in Clackamas County last year. A three-year-old girl in Bend was hurt before that, and you'll find many more of these stories from law enforcement. So with that, thank you for your consideration.
So just to clarify, your understanding is that a properly trained, certified service monkey would be exempt from the ban proposed in this bill. In other words, would not be subject to the ban proposed in this bill. Did I understand you correctly?
The ADA supersedes a state law, so what I'm saying is there's no need to adopt an additional amendment on this.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the ADA, I would assume then that there are appropriate standards defining how a service animal is classified with regards to potentially exotic animals. Is that correct?
I understand it, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Senator Haft, you say there's no need to exempt them, and I'm certainly not going to quarrel with you over that, whether there is or isn't a need. But my question is, would you have objections to a bill or an amendment of that nature referencing back to the federal ADA provisions?
I just don't think it's necessary.
I understand you're having said that, Senator. My question is, would you object to that?
I would.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's move next to Scott Beckstead, Nicole Paquette, and Tony Vecchio. Yeah, so we have, come as no surprise, we have a number of folks signed up to testify. We are on very tight time limit, so I'm going to put the clock at 3 minutes each and ask you, if possible, to be even briefer than that. So in any order.
Thank you. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Scott Beckstead. I'm the Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. On behalf of our 145,000 members throughout the state of Oregon, I want to express our support for Senate Bill 391. This is an important bill that addresses both animal welfare concerns as well as human health and safety concerns. In addition to the incidents that Senator Haas raised, I want to also make sure that the committee is aware of some other incidents that pertain specifically to the proposed amendment, which would exempt small monkeys under 22 pounds. Douglas County experienced two attacks by small monkeys, one on a paper boy who was delivering a paper to one of his customers, and a capuchin monkey jumped onto his head from a rooftop and attacked him. In a second incident, a man was attacked by escaped macaque monkey, which are known carriers of herpes virus, and this poor individual had to undergo quite a bit of medical treatment to address that problem. In addition, my spouse served for 4 years as the animal control officer for the Lincoln County Sheriff, and she was involved in an incident. Actually, she was called away from our Easter dinner to chase a escaped capuchin monkey through the neighborhoods of Lincoln City. Obviously, that spread a great deal of fear and alarm throughout that neighborhood in Lincoln City. The fact is that small primates have very sharp teeth. They are prone to bite, especially as they reach adulthood. And they very often carry zoonotic diseases or diseases that can easily be transmitted from them to humans. This is essentially, members of the committee, the same bill that has already received broad bipartisan support in previous sessions, with the exception that it adds members of the crocodile family. We believe that it's important both to protect these animals from being in the hands of people who don't understand how to take care of them, as well as to protect the citizens of this state. These animals should be held only by individuals that own a valid USDA permit. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. President. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
We'll wait until we've heard from Marie and then.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nicole Paquette, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Born Free USA. We're a national wildlife advocacy organization, and we strongly support SB 391. Oregon currently requires that all persons possessing exotic animals obtain a license. And what this bill, all it does is simply turns that license into a grandfather clause and then prohibits future ownership of these animals. The bill currently contains the same exemptions that are in existing law. Specifically, it does exempt USDA-licensed facilities. That could be exhibitors, breeders, research facilities, or dealers. And all of those people are exempt from that bill. And typically in the past years that we've had this bill, individuals who have testified have all had USDA license. So it is important to note that those people are exempt from this bill. In addition, we have added alligators and crocodiles, and we've put in an exemption in that to include anyone who has an approved facility that houses alligators. They can take in an additional alligators at the request of a state or local government. So again, there's an exemption for people who've rescued alligators and crocodiles. Now, the current legislative trend across the country is in passing these prohibitions, because there is a trend all across the country of these exotic animals attacking as well as escaping and causing havoc amongst these communities. And again, 22 states currently have no ban in place, and 28 states do. Oregon is in that 22. And 17 states have passed their laws in the past 10 years. So it is important to note that it is a trend. Just a couple notes on some of the possible amendments. If we were to exempt the wildcats and the smaller primates, I mean, this essentially complicates the existing scheme that is in place. You're going to have some animals banned, some animals licensed, and having it clear the way it is written in SB 391 simply phases out that licensing system and therefore doesn't complicate what the ODA currently has in place. And then with respect to the helper monkey issue, currently the American Veterinary Medical Association actually does have a policy statement against helper monkeys. So that is important to know, that the veterinarians out there actually don't support exempting helper monkeys. Again, we've worked with the opposition over the years. We've taken numerous amendments, and I think this is a really good, strong bill, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Tony Vecchio. I'm the director of the Oregon Zoo. I worked with exotic animals for 32 years in five different zoos, and I hold a master's degree in primate behavior. So I'm familiar with exotic animals and the the wonderfulness of being around animals, but also the dangers that they pose. We get hundreds of calls at the zoo every year, hundreds from people that are trying to place their animals that they got thinking they would make great pets, only to find out that exotic animals don't make great pets. They're captive does not mean tame. These animals are either removed from the wild or recently removed from the wild, and they still have natural instincts that cause them to be dangerous. I will tell you, when I was a zookeeper, I worked with large cats and bears. I've been bitten twice by Siberian tigers and once by a polar bear. I wasn't a very good zookeeper. I didn't mention that. But nonetheless, when I tell people about the worst experience I had in my entire zoo career, it was a bite from a small primate that put me in the hospital for a week and almost caused me to have my right arm amputated. It's not the size of the teeth or the size of the animal so much as the fact that these animals do carry zoonotic diseases. I wouldn't recommend a polar bear as a pet either, because in that case it is the size of the animal. But just simply enough, exotic animals don't make good pets for several reasons, and it's not just whether they can kill you or not. They do carry diseases, particularly primates carry diseases that human beings are susceptible to, as I found out the hard way. I have many reasons to support this bill. That safety one is a very important one to me. Zoos just don't have the room to take all the animals that are out there looking for homes. And as I said, we get those calls all the time. But also, I'm a conservationist and environmentalist, and I do know these animals escape into the wild. Sometimes frustrated owners release the animals into the wild. And in our habitats, our natural habitats here, we have these dangerous exotics kind of wreaking havoc with the native wildlife and so forth. There are conservation reasons for to support this bill, as well as the safety and the health reasons. So I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Vecchio, and for your service to the Oregon Zoo. We'll miss you as you take off for other parts.
Thank you very much. Leaving Oregon was an extremely difficult decision.
Any questions for this panel, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talk to us about wolves. We delete wolves because wolves are native, because they're not as dangerous, because we do a pretty good job with wolves. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, the wolves were exempted, but it is because they are native, and so they're covered under DFW regulations. So, I mean, we're purely dealing with the captive exotic animal species in this particular bill.
You probably already answered. Thanks.
Representative Jensen?
Yes. So in all of the illustrations of danger by the small primates, or harm by the small primates, how many of them were helper animals?
Do you want to answer? Do you have that?
Well, I don't actually know the answer.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Chair Cannon, we know that the monkey that was involved in the attack in, I believe it was March, on a six-year-old girl here in Salem, that was a helper monkey. I don't specifically know how many other of the primates that were involved in attacks here in Oregon were helper monkeys. I do know for certain that the one most recently here in Salem was a helper monkey.
Well, I think it's generally safe to say, isn't it, that any animal is dangerous? The Homo sapien being a classic example.
Present company excluded, of course.
I'll ask, the protocol here is not to make any expressions of support or opposition, vocal or clapping, so keep that down, please.
Well,
go ahead.
I would agree with you that any animal is potentially dangerous, just as any person is potentially dangerous. But once again, I refer to the difference between a domestic animal and a captive animal. And a domestic animal is one that's been bred for hundreds or thousands of generations to be around people. And the aggressive, rather dangerous instincts that they have been bred out of them. Can they still bite you? Absolutely. Dogs can be quite dangerous, which only, I think, emphasizes how much danger there is in a wild animal that hasn't had that benefit of thousands of generations of breeding to remove those traits. Those traits are still very close to the surface in any exotic wild animal.
And one more comment on the smaller monkeys. My organization owns and operates a primate sanctuary. We have 500 monkeys that are under the weight of 22 pounds. And most of the primates that have been turned over to us have actually been because they've attacked their owner, and they no longer can actually handle them. So they're afraid to actually live with them. We put them in a more natural environment and let them actually be monkeys. So again, there's a lot more reported incidences out there than just what you would actually hear about in the paper, and it is all across the country. So these animals, you know, when they do definitely have the opportunity to be dangerous, and you know, we shouldn't be owning them as pets.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I ask my question, I want just to be sure on this point. My understanding is the zookeeper, we've lost the zookeeper, is that correct? It's just a really
well,
bad
I keep
joke.
I keep track of my zookeepers, but
usually you lose the animals. But anyway, my point is, and I think the chair now wants me to get to it. If I'd been voting in this legislature when I was 13 and been attacked by I was bitten by a German Shepherd, I probably would have voted for a bill to outlaw German Shepherds. My point is, these are helping animals. This is the part of the bill I'm particularly concerned about. The helping animals, I believe, should be exempted. And I was a little confused by the earlier testimony, because on one hand, I took the senator to mean that he thought they should be exempted, and then when pressed, he would not support the amendment. But I wouldn't want us, because of an incident that was reported, then to make a blanket statement that therefore helping animals are by and large dangerous. Would you agree with that?
This is not my area of expertise, but I will tell you my understanding is that the amendment is unnecessary because the American with Disabilities Act supersedes any state law, so that they are protected. I have my own opinions about helper animals, and just from the research I've read, I would never recommend to somebody to get a helper monkey. I don't think they make good helpers. I think there's enough studies been done that have shown that they're not an effective animal to help somebody with a disability. There are other ways that are better to get the support you need. But again, I couldn't argue with the reasoning for putting that in the American with Disabilities Act.
Well, and then, I mean, the federal law does say that any animal that's been trained for assistance and actually has been trained to assist a specific disability is exempt. And it's the term animal is left very generic as animal. So it can be an exotic, it can be a dog, it can be a horse, it could be a parrot. And so, again, I totally agree that it's unnecessary to actually put an additional amendment in this bill, given that the American with Disabilities clearly supersedes the state law.
Follow up. The part that bothers me, though, is that everybody so far that's testifying seems to say it's unnecessary, but I also sense a very distinct undercurrent that you're against the whole idea of the helping animal for perhaps reasons of your own, but it doesn't seem to match up. In other words, for me, if you think it's covered, then opposition to the amendment doesn't make sense to me.
I guess the bigger issue is that, I mean, the way that the bill is written currently is, in my opinion, it already exempts them. So in order to, you know, move the bill forward, I just don't think you need to add that additional language. The majority of state laws out there on this issue, again, there are 28 states that ban. There are 13 states that regulate. I can only think of probably 4 or 5 states that actually address the helper monkey issue, and it's never been a problem nationwide. So, again, you know, I work on this nationally. I've assisted numerous states, and we just simply don't put that language in the bills. Washington State banned it in 2007. The language simply is not in there. It just has not been an issue. So I just feel like why put additional language in there when it really isn't an issue?
One last follow-up. Yeah. So politically, when you're trying to get a bill through, you don't. I understand that point of view. So you don't want to encumber it because you've got a bill that you want to get through this legislature as well.
Well, no, I just... I mean, I guess I like when language is very simple and succinct, and I just don't think by adding that language it's really necessary. I guess that's because the ADA covers it already.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that I have learned today for the first time that there is something called a helper monkey that is not a name my wife gives to me, curious, how many of these are there in the state of Oregon? Do we know?
Well, I don't think there are very many. I mean, well, from my research, there's a group that trains monkeys, and they're called Helping Hands. And that's the only group that I know that specifically trains monkeys for this purpose. And it's for paraplegics. And then they have a little, I think they call it a monkey school, and they basically train these monkeys to help paraplegics. So it is a small number. It's a very small number that would meet that definition.
So would it be safe to say that perhaps part of the reluctance to include the amendment is that there is the potential of creating an incongruity with federal law for a small number of individuals, that it's better to keep our law consistent with the federal law?
I think that would be a good way to explain it, yes.
Thank you very much. So, last question, Representative Smith. We have about 15 more folks signed up for this bill, and we want to try to hear from them in the next hour. So,
okay. I can skip one of my questions. May I do ask this? I am aware of helper monkeys from the movie Monkey Shine, in which the monkey committed violent crimes at the whims of the psychically linked owner, played by, I believe, Ryan O'Neal. And we certainly don't want that in our state. But I do want to deal with this more seriously than the Monkey Shines comment would suggest. It would seem to me we'd flip it. Like, if there's significant concern that we're not addressing helper animals sufficiently, and our response is, well, because we don't need to, because it's already in the ADA. And my response is, well, why don't we, if it's already in the ADA?
Why don't we add the amendment?
Yeah.
Could I? Yeah, go ahead.
And believe me, my opinion, I didn't help put the legislation together. I don't know. I have my own opinion, and that would be that I'm sure in the Americans with Disabilities Act, the criteria for defining what a helper monkey is was very well thought out and researched and identified. I'm not sure that it is the same in the amendment. I would hate to see somebody use the amendment in this bill to include animals that weren't quite as strictly controlled as they would be just following the Americans with Disabilities Act. Anybody that could go out and buy a monkey and say, well, I just need it because it makes me feel better, therefore it's a helper monkey. That wouldn't be allowed with the Americans with Disability Act, but I don't know if this amendment is that well thought out.
And that's a wonderful point, too. And in addition, I mean, I would be afraid that somebody would just go and their doctors and get a note and say, oh, this monkey needs, I need this monkey to make myself feel a little bit better each day because I'm depressed. I mean, again, that wouldn't cover it under the ADA.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm sure you'll stick around. Let's hear next from, I'm just going to go back and forth between panels of supporters and opponents. You must have worked this out very well, because I think there are equal numbers of both, so we can stagger it very nicely. Thank you very much for that. Lauren Henry, Mike Daly, and Roland Sonnenberg. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay.
And I will be using the clock for you as well, so please limit your comments and keep it brief. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you guys very much. I'm Lauren Henry. I am here to ask you to vote no on Senate Bill 391. I have a bachelor's degree in animal science with a minor in chemistry, graduate work in veterinary immunology and nutrition, and I'm a USDA license holder as an exhibitor. Now, you may think that I don't have any problems with this bill because I do have a USDA license. However, if you read the language, if in a few years I am no longer exhibiting my animals and I do not have my USDA license anymore, I no longer meet the definitions for this law and my animals can be removed and taken from me. There's only a one-year period in the current writing of the bill that allows people to keep their animals with this grandfather clause. So let's say in a few years I don't want to exhibit anymore, but I still am very capable of keeping my animals. There is no provision in this bill for me to allow to continue keeping my animals for the rest of their lives without that USDA license. Also, if in a year or two, once this bill has passed, somebody in Oregon would like to go into business as an exhibitor, training animals for film or something like that, this law does not give them a way to get the animals to obtain the USDA license. So they will not be able to go into their chosen field of employment or into their business ownership, and they too may be very, very capable of taking wonderful care of these animals. Young people will not have opportunities in the future to work with, learn about, and grow in their chosen field with animals in Oregon. There will likely be maybe dogs and cats available, but not the 2-pound fennec fox or a 10-pound serval. They will all be illegal, but they're not necessarily a danger to society. The concern about zoonotics was brought up, but we just learned that, you know, with swine flu, pigs carry zoonotic diseases as well. So I think the risk is quite low. My issue is that I really think this is mostly coming up because you just want to get a law on the books and have this issue go away, that it's been coming up year after year after year, and you just want it to be gone. And I don't think that's necessarily a reason to pass a law. So my suggestion is, could Oregon develop an act, perhaps called the Oregon Animal Care and Husbandry Act, that allows people who can do it well to go through the training process and certification to own the animals of their choice, and the state can fund it, could be a revenue generator for the state. But people in Oregon are given the opportunity to pursue the care of animals as they feel necessary. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks for your testimony. Let me just clarify, when you were describing the possibility that you would lose your animals, that would be if your license lapses for some reason.
You I choose not to exhibit, so I no longer meet the definition of a USDA exhibitor.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Roland Sonnenberg. I also run a business training animals for the movies and have trained animals for hundreds of movies and commercials. I have a degree in philosophy and physics, and I am a published author on animal ethics, care, and training, and have consulted for National Geographic Guide Dogs for the Blind and Disney. I'm also USDA, so I'm not affected by this law. I'm here today not to try and fight for my desires, excuse me, but to tell you what I have experienced working with people who have these animals who don't have a license. The bill appears very simple on the face of it, and I think it's important that we understand that there are issues underlying it that you may not have thought of. You will be told or have been told that this bill is to protect the public from animals getting loose and harming people, that this bill is to protect people from zoonotic diseases, that the bill is about protecting animals who may be dumped or neglected by owners when they stop being cute. None of those, I think, are the real reasons. And that's clear because if you look at the cases that you've heard, there have been very few cases of any of those things happening in this state. The few that have happened, there have been virtually no injuries. I'll go back to the alligator story for a minute. It's a perfect example. It was not a beast that escaped and terrorized Portland. It was a 4-foot alligator that waddled around for a day. And it's also important to recognize that after the police realized they didn't know what to do, what they did do was call one of the very people that this law will put out of business. And they called a person who was not USDA licensed, but was one of these experts that we're talking about today, who was the person who came and helped. And if you look over 10 years, there have been a handful of these stories, virtually none of them resulting in any problems. By the way, going back for a second, on the amendment, the amendment actually references the ADA, so essentially the law for the amendment would be the same. It would basically say, hey, any animal that meets the ADA standards is exempt. So if I tell you that basically none of these problems have realistically occurred and that all of the stories that you are going to hear today or have heard today are already people who are breaking the laws, there are approximately 50 people in this state who have successfully jumped through all of the hurdles to legally own any exotic animals. None of those people are the people you're going to hear stories about. You're going to hear stories about people who are already breaking the law, whose illegal animals got loose and didn't hurt anyone. Those are not particularly compelling stories, and most importantly, we already have excellent laws on the book, and we can stop those people anytime we want. So I really think the underlying issue that we're here talking about today is whether or not people should have exotic animals. And while we are all kind of talking about the trappings of that, really the core issue is, should these animals be pets or not? Is that right? And I think you will find most of the people who support this bill basically believe these animals don't belong in captivity. And we can come up with reasons of disease or danger, but really they don't believe they should be there. And I think you will find that the people who are opposing this bill are essentially saying there are cases where animals should be in captivity, and that the animals that are kept by these 50 people who have put in the time and energy to get a license are in fact living lives that are better than they could live in the wild. They are not covered with parasites. They are not starving to death. They are not freezing cold. They are getting great veterinary care. These people are building rooms onto their houses to house these animals. These people adore these animals. These people are going to lectures and learning tons about these animals so that they can give them incredible lives. These are not the people who get animals and a few years later dump them. These are people who have spent tens of thousands of dollars and years to become experts in this.
And, sir, I've given you more than your 3 minutes.
Can I give you my last sentence? So I totally actually agree with the general gist that there are a lot of people who shouldn't own exotic animals, and I really want to thank you guys and your predecessors for giving us incredible laws that prevent those people from owning exotic animals and that give us great laws to stop anyone who isn't doing a good job. But I'm here to say today that there are people who should, and that we need to not pass this law or pass it with the amendment so that those people who can and should own animals can.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, sir.
Chairman Ben Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Mike Daly. Up until the first of the year, I was an elected official. I was a Deschutes County Commissioner. Commissioner for 8 years in Deschutes County. I'm very much aware of the awesome responsibility elected officials have trying to protect the public while also trying to be fair to all the parties concerned. Up until September 11th of last year, my wife Darlene and I owned a small capuchin monkey. He was with us for over 13 years and was the joy of our life. He had a congenital heart defect, apparently from birth, and he died. During the time he was with us, he had a wonderful life. He was part of our family. Senate Bill 391 has been proposed as a public safety measure to protect the public from wild and dangerous animals. This is the third legislative session that the sponsors of this bill have proposed this type of legislation. It was defeated the first two times as bad legislation, and it should be defeated this time also. Those of us who have owned exotic animals recognize that having a 400-pound chimp in your backyard or a large lion or tiger is not appropriate. The problem with this bill is that when you use the term all non-human primates, it includes the large dangerous primates as well as the very small squirrel monkeys. Some of these animals are obviously not appropriate as pets, but some are. You will hear testimony that these animals carry all these exotic diseases. The last time I checked with the Center for Disease Control, there had never been an instance in the United States where a pet monkey had transmitted any of these diseases to any human. It just hasn't happened. I know of one instance where a worker in a primate research center contracted a fatal disease from a monkey. But this was a monkey imported from outside the U.S. for medical research. I am referring to pet monkeys who are all captive bred within the United States. The sponsors of this bill know this, but will lead you to believe this is a very big problem. You all have staff members. Ask them to call the CDC and check this out. You need the correct information before you can make an informed decision. You have all heard of the Helping Hands program from Boston University. Small capuchin monkeys are trained to assist severely disabled people in their homes. This bill would effectively destroy this opportunity for disabled persons. By the way, I just saw a news release the other day that there are over 100 Helping Hands monkeys in the United States at this point in time from this program. I've attached an article from the Internet where a police SWAT team in Mesa, Arizona has applied for a $100,000 grant from the federal government to buy a capuchin monkey and train it to perform law enforcement duties.
And if you would please conclude your testimony.
Officer, what?
Would you please conclude your testimony? Your time is up.
All right. Officers say a monkey, police monkey, could search buildings and find bodies. This bill as proposed would not allow that, our local police agencies, to do that. That article is here on the back page if you'd like to read it. In closing, I've had 15 years of primates living in my home, and we pretty well know what's going on. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you all for testifying. Let's move on to our next panel, which will include Carrie Tyler, Susan Mentley, and Dr. Larry Peets. Please go ahead. Yeah. It works.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Larry Peets. I'm a veterinarian in private practice and have been in practice in Oregon for almost 40 years. And I'm here to support this Senate Bill 391 again. I want to commend Representative Haas for his persistence and trying to get this legislation through. I would encourage you to pass this bill without amendments. It appears that the USDA and the covers the bases. I wanted to speak from the animal welfare. You've heard all about horror stories and that kind of stuff. My personal experience in practice with exotic animals is that it never ends up good for the animal. The trade in exotic animals, although and I'm not addressing the helper monkeys that are bred within the United States, but other birds that are birds and exotics that are brought into this country from outside the United States, it promotes carnage of these animals are inhumanely treated. The trade is deplorable, and if we as Oregonians could pass legislation that would limit this, I think it would be in the best interest of our citizens. Certainly it would of the animals. The public health issues with zoonotic diseases, it's not a myth. It is a reality. Unfortunately, as veterinarians in practice, when we see a lot of the exotic critters that are brought in, they've lived in inadequate cares. You can't duplicate the habitat where these critters would live if they were in their normal habitat. So large cats and reptiles that people take as pets and try to make they're not domesticated the way dogs and cats are. So I think, I'd like to see you recommend this bill be passed without amendments. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's hear from the other two members of this panel. Go ahead.
Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. I am Deputy Animal Service Deputy Carrie Tyler from Lincoln County. My county has a very small shelter. We have two animal services deputies. I've been in animal control field for the better part of the last 20 years. I do support this bill, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Animal Control Council, which is a statewide organization involving animal control officers. Our training does not include enough training on exotics to keep us safe, nor are our shelters set up to house these animals, so they create a very big nightmare for us. We stress companion animals. We have very much training in that, and I, for that reason, I support this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Susan Mentley, and I work at the Oregon Humane Society, which is based in Portland. I've been in the Humane Society business for over 30 years now, and I've been at the Oregon Humane Society for the last 11. Exotics, and I do need to equivocate, excuse me, I'm sure that there's wonderful owners that provide incredible care for exotics, but what we see mostly within my business are the casual owners. And the casual owners are the ones that may acquire an animal casually, and by the time that they've decided they can no longer care for it, it's been depleted. We've seen that with the large reptiles, specifically the little iguana craze that went through about 10 years ago. And anything that becomes popular, sooner or later, we're going to get. And it's a conundrum why somebody would bring an exotic animal to a dog and cat shelter. But I can tell you that they do. And I can also tell you that when it's time to try to find a rescue, it is virtually impossible. So it doesn't turn out well. We see a lot of animals out there. It goes without saying that dogs and cats die every day here in Oregon because there's not enough homes. So from a Humane Society standpoint, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to keep these animals as pets.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your testimony. I wonder if you had a chance to look at the bill, and do the exemptions in here, is essentially grandfathering folks who have a USDA license, is that a sensible way to try to approach this issue? I mean, you described that there are some owners out there who probably are providing a safe and appropriate home for these exotics. Does this bill strike the right kind of balance?
In my mind, it does. That was a very good point, though, from the person that testified before regarding the sunset or the time allowed after they stop exhibiting. You know, in my heart of hearts, they would keep these animals for the rest of their natural lives because where else are they going to go? So that makes a good point. However, I think the exemptions do make sense. I went to school for occupational therapy, and I've worked with the ADA quite a bit, and it does stand to reason that their definitions are much tougher than anything we're going to come up with. So I think that the exemptions do work, but I would look at that the one particular exemption that was being referred to concerning the year after exhibiting.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you very much, for Representative Boone.
Quick
before
one
you leave.
For Lincoln County. I've heard that the shelters are closing down there. Is that true?
It looks like it may. We just have one shelter. It's a very well-run small shelter, and they've decided to make the budget cuts there, and we're struggling to keep it open right now.
And a follow-up. It looks like in Section 4, is it 4? Maybe that doesn't fit. Line 17, page 2, a wildlife rehab center. I was looking for a shelter that doesn't address shelters, but... Oh, gosh. I thought I saw it somewhere. Anyway, what would happen to a wildlife rehab center if you don't have a shelter? I know it's not in my district, but it's very close. It's in Witt's district, that Charnel Fay's wildlife rehab center. But she takes mostly birds, but a lot of sea animals, too. What happens to something like that?
Do you know how to address that?
Well, regarding this nothing, of course. Those are
already
indigenous wildlife.
This rehab,
so it would just be a matter of funding.
Wildlifes aren't exotics.
Okay.
That's a good distinction.
Thanks. I haven't had quite enough coffee or something. I should have caught that. I feel like an idiot now.
So. No.
But anyway, I was worried about that because we do have occasion often also down in Lincoln City that Bruce Mates... usually the guy they call when a sea animal washes up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And from my read of the bill, and perhaps Representative Boone, other members, other folks will come up and clarify this, but the exemptions in Section 4 include a wildlife rehabilitation center as well as a wildlife sanctuary. Wildlife sanctuary is defined on page 1 to include places of refuge where abused, neglected, unwanted, impounded, et cetera, exotic animals are provided care. I think it's worth looking through the exemptions there in Section 4, but I think the intention is at least to capture the kind of treatment, kind of center that you're describing.
So wildlife is considered local wildlife.
Yeah, I mean, it says, it does say exotic animal under the definition of wildlife
displaced,
sanctuary.
Yeah. So, okay, all right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's hear next from Robert. I'm sorry, I can't read your... It might be Prue or Drew, Molly Schaefer, and Mike Mills.
Good
think Mike Mills is not testifying.
Okay, Cheryl Jones, if you want to come on up.
Do you want to? You're not testifying either. She submitted written testimony.
Great. Is that true also for Steve Higgs? You want to come on up, Mr. Higgs? Okay, why don't we start with either of you? Go ahead, sir. You're on.
My name is Robert Alley. I think I'm the person that you are looking for.
Yeah.
A-U-E is the last name.
Uh-huh.
And at this time, I own three non-human primates. And I believe that the state of Oregon, I believe in the liberties that the state allows. And I just think that there's some possible ways we can look at education instead of perhaps just another bill. We're not going to be able to get rid of the animals that are illegally owned in this state. I think there's enough education out there. I think it just needs to be presented to the people that perhaps have these animals that aren't being registered. If we could possibly register these people, I think that we would end up a much, much better world in everyone's eyes. We're not going to be able to enforce this new bill as it's written now, I don't believe. I think we need to look at that real closely.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Molly Schaefer. I own a USDA licensed facility in Marion County. I've been there for over 20 years. I was actually in on the 609-305, the original drafting of those laws regarding exotic animals in the 1990s with state vet Dr. Clark at that time. So I'm very familiar with the current laws that we have. They've worked really well. Other states have used them as a... a template basically for making their own laws. We have, for the last three sessions, fought this bill. We have every session asked to sit down with the proponents and speak about the bill and try to come up with a happy medium, and each time we have been denied. So a large group of us got together this time and wrote the 8-2 amendments, which we feel are reasonable and fair. We also don't believe that your neighbor should be able to have a tiger or a chimpanzee in their backyard. However, if your neighbor wants to have a 12-ounce marmoset in their house or a 4-pound Joffrey cat, we don't feel that that's a hazard to the other citizens of Oregon. One thing that is kind of confusing... when people are talking about animals that are imported and being used as pets, I think they're mostly referring to crocodilians. The United States passed a law in the early 1970s that makes it illegal to import primates for the pet industry. The only people that can import primates are research facilities and universities. So the animals that we're talking about as far as primates that are available in the pet trade have been bred in captivity for almost 40 years. And the only people allowed to breed primates are USDA licensed facilities. So these animals are not carrying diseases. They've had veterinary records. USDA is very strict with us on what we can and can't do and where we obtain the animals from and who we sell to. They inspect us twice a year and they go over our records. So that's, I think, kind of a misnomer. I think when they're talking about imported animals, and I know Senator Boquist was referring to crocodilians, not exotic cats or primates. The black market trade on exotic animals, as far as the monkeys and that sort of thing, are for bush meat. They come in dead and dried. They're not for the pet market. That's just something I thought you should know. The other thing, the average monkey costs $6,500 and up. So this isn't an animal that you're going to go out and buy at a pet store for your child. So it's not an impulse purchase. The other thing is that in order to bring a monkey into the state, a person has to, before they can get an import permit to bring it in, the monkey has to be tested for tuberculosis, salmonella, Arizona, Shigella, internal and external parasites before the state will issue an import permit. And also required for an individual is that they have to apply for a state permit. They have to pay for the license. They have to have a state vet come out and inspect their home, inspect the caging, and they interview you regarding the knowledge of care. So it's not an easy thing to bring a monkey into the state of Oregon legally. And chances are, if you brought that monkey in, it's healthy. Okay, I'm sorry. The other thing that they are talking about is there's no rescues. There are primate rescues in Oregon. There are big cat rescues in Oregon. And there are reptile rescues in Oregon. And I guess I'll conclude.
And we have your written testimony. Thank you very much for preparing that. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Steve Higgs. I am also USDA. But we do have a rescue facility. We do take in all the animals that you're talking about. In fact, over in Vancouver, they passed a law about crocodilians, and we, within 30 days, had 10 alligators placed with our place. It's something that I think is going to happen here, too, once we pass this. And that puts the state police and everybody else in a position of where are we going to take these. Now, we can accept these ourselves, but how many can we take? As far as the other exotic animals, we do take a lot of exotic animals in. And, yes, there are some people that have got them. They were furry little pets at one time. But most cases, when any of the ones that we have received, are animals that through death or something like that, they can no longer be taken care of by the people that now they've been passed down to. And in most of these animals, they, you know, like the zoo individual says, that he's been bit a few times. Well, most of the animals he's dealing with are wild animals. These are animals that are not the animals that we end up with that are raised from cubs all the way up, ball raised, and are handled all the time. So most of these animals can be and are very easily able to be worked with. As far as the monkeys, I agree that I don't see why this amendment is. If there's a problem as far as these people that are going to have these monkeys as helpers, why not have it on the amendment? I mean, the only thing I see that what they're really striking out to do is to take away all these, one step at a time, to take away all our rights to have these animals. And again, like they were saying, if we're in a position where something happens to us, or we no longer want to be a rescue facility, or we no longer are able to continue to have these animals, because after a year, or after the time when our USDA license expires and we don't want to renew it, who's going to take these animals? Are we going to take and go and euthanize them? The zoo obviously says they cannot handle them. They don't want them. They don't need them. And so it's kind of one of those things that it's something we have to really look at. I think that there's a lot of parts of this new amendment that they're trying to give to you guys that is really important for us all to be looking at. And all these places that are saying that they don't have a place to take these animals, we have opened up our doors to every one of them. And have offered it, and we were getting a lot of animals from the Oregon area as well as a lot from Washington, and these are mainly the stuff that's being told that people can no longer have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Here's what I'm having trouble understanding. So you all are, and most of the other folks we've heard from, have USDA permits. I understand your concern. What if the permit lapses, and under this bill, at least that was one concern we heard, under this bill, it might be difficult, if not impossible, to reobtain a permit, but there is a series of exemptions in Section 4 that do include wildlife sanctuaries, wildlife rehabilitation centers. So I think animal protection organizations, law enforcement, licensed veterinary hospital or clinic, educational facility. So I think speaking particularly to your concerns, it would appear that there is, this bill does provide for a system to the maintenance of a system to accept these exotics when they come out of the homes of folks who are not licensed, or the owner dies, or whatnot. And so I'm not sure I'm really understanding your concerns given the ways in which this tries to create exemptions.
Do you mind if I answer the question? What you probably don't realize, in order to have a USDA license, we have to use our animals in a commercial capacity. So, for instance, currently, I do rescue, I breed, and I'm a dealer also. If I decide that I want to retire, which I'd like to do sometime in the next 10 years, and not sell animals, not do rescue, not exhibit animals, all of the animals that I currently have that have been my pets for many years, they're not just breeders, they're my pets. I've raised most of them from small babies. I would not be able to get a state permit at that point because 1 year will have passed. Therefore, I will not be qualified by law to keep those animals. So all the animals that I've had and raised for sometimes 20, 30 years, I would not be able to keep those animals because I wouldn't be able to have a USDA license because I'm not doing a commercial activity, nor would I be able to obtain a state permit because the state permit system will have been abolished.
And you don't believe that you would qualify under the exemptions in Section 4, wildlife sanctuary, exotic animal protection organization,
no.
Wildlife rehabilitation
I know
center.
That I don't qualify under any of those. Okay. Absolutely do not.
One of the things also, we put out an exhibit every year. We have about 1.5 million people that go through our exhibit every year. We meet people all the time that have these animals that are not USDA, but what they have got them through various processes. I agree with what he was saying. It would be nice to be able to do a licensing thing where we had some way of knowing where these animals are so that the people could come out of the woodwork there and come up and say, hey, yeah, I do have this. I want to have a license. We work with Fish and Wildlife also where we ourselves are able to have all the animals that are prohibited. And what we do is we do a display and explain to people why they should not have them, why the reasons are, why Oregon does not want to have them, and so forth. And why is that? That's because they cannot do it themselves. They cannot get the exposure that we can get and be able to help them out in such a way. But again, this way, we also are able to bring in a lot of the animals that people are trying to get rid of, and we are able to take care of them. And my hope is that through this amendment, we can continue to be able to do these, and the people that do have them will be able to continue to have them.
Thank you. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the section at the end, I think it's Section 8, that talks about the permit that may be issued. And I think there, if I understand it correctly, there are two situations. The first one is if a permit is applied for within 90 days after the effective date of the Act. And the second is that the department may issue within one year of the effective date of the Act a permit to a person to possess an exotic animal if the person submits satisfactory proof that the person possessed the exotic animal prior to the effective date of the Act. I guess that's all one thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It sounds to me as though one of the issues that you have raised and at least one other person raised might require another exception that would allow for those who have licenses from the United States to apply for a permit at a time when they are switching occupations to maintain the animals that they've kept as pets. I'm not sure how you'd word such a thing, but would that take care of at least that piece of your objection?
Representative Barnhart, that would, and that's something that we brought up when this bill was on the Senate side and tried to explain that, you know, for one reason or another, whether it be that I'm old and want to retire or that I get ill, mm-hmm. I need to be able to drop that USDA license but still maintain my collection of animals until they die. And the way the bill is written, I absolutely would not be able to do that. I would be required to keep my USDA license, which means I'm going to have to continue to breed or do a commercial activity, which is, I think, exactly what the proponents of the bill don't want me doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of consistent with Representative Barnhart's question, do you have a copy of the bill there?
I don't, but I'm pretty familiar with it.
On page 2, paragraph 4A, line 40, says a person may breed a small exotic feline if the person, and then there's a subsection that says, is exempt from the requirements, which you would not be because you're not a law enforcement agency, a veterinary hospital, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says, or breeds a small exotic feline with a member of the species Felis catus. That seems odd to me. Is that what you're in the business of doing?
I think what that may be referring to is the people that breed hybrid cats. There is a fairly popular cat out called a Savannah cat, and what that is an African serval cat, normally male, that's bred to a domestic cat. I believe that's what they're referring to there. And that would still be allowed to happen as long as the people were selling the offspring to the pet industry. However, what the bill doesn't do is once, let's say, the male serval cat that they're using as the stud, once that cat were to die, they would not be able to replace it. And so, in essence, their entire business of hybridizing cats would go down the drain at the same time because they wouldn't be allowed to replace that cat that died. So, again, you know, they can continue their business for the life of their breeder cat. Once their breeder cat is dead, their business is dead. So it really is not a true exemption.
Philip?
Yes, it's more than I ever wanted to know about this.
Probably so.
Yes.
But that is consistent with, I mean, that's the way the bill is supposed to be crafted. Am I understanding it right?
They put that exemption in there to, because the last session, the hybrid people, there's a lot of them, and they're very, the hybrid cats are very popular pets. And a lot of the hybrid people got up and screamed and said, no, wait a minute. So they put that exemption in there, but what it doesn't allow them to do, and the hybridizers don't seem to realize that, is that once their exotic cat, who's their stud cat, passes away, they're out of business because they can't replace that cat.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I want to make this comment. First of all, I appreciate very much this hearing and affording all points of view, but my observation is, reading Molly's testimony, is that I think this is a little bit odd for the way we normally conduct business here, and that is this, that we've, I guess this has been here three sessions, and we have a what I would term a one-size-fits-all national agenda. But we haven't had what appears to me an airing. I don't want to bring up the dreaded option of a work group, but I am saying the fact that all stakeholders haven't had an opportunity around the context of this bill to try to work something out or negotiate, it concerns me, and I just wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Well, let me just note that I think there are others who might disagree with that characterization of the process. I'm not taking a position on it myself, but there is written testimony to suggest the contrary. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it, Molly, is it acceptable with the amendment, the -2 amendment?
It is, honestly. After doing some deep soul searching, currently there's only one person anyway that has a large exotic cat with a permit in the state. I've worked with large cats, I've worked with bears, I've worked with large primates. The average person probably is not qualified and should not own one. And the reason that we drafted the A2 amendments was to keep people from owning those animals that really do have a potential to be an extreme danger. Yet the people that have their little beloved Fluffy that sleeps with them and you know, is a good companion animal, we feel that they should be allowed to keep those animals. And the A2 amendments would allow them to keep the smaller, more benign pets, yet ban the chimpanzees. The other example that was brought up was the macaque that bit somebody and the person had to be quarantined and so forth. This A2 amendment would ban macaques. Macaques are over 10 kilograms. So the amendment would take care of that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Now I'm confused because, if I may, the A2 amendment doesn't do anything with Section 8, which has to do with licensure. And I thought we'd just discussed the need for some kind of a way of extending USDA licensed people who want to retire in, and yet the A2 amendment doesn't deal with that question at all, as far as I can tell.
Representative Barnhart, you're correct. The majority of the USDA breeders in the state of Oregon, and again, there are some that are not, but the majority of us do not raise animals that would not be exempt anyway. So, for instance, in my case, I wouldn't have an issue with it because, with the exception of one animal on my place, which by the time I retire will have passed away from old age, the rest of my animals would fall under the small, harmless pets and would be exempted anyway.
Okay.
So that would take care of that.
Make sure I understand, if I may, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying, I think, is that the definitional changes that are made in the A2 amendments would take care of, would essentially define your animals out of the bill.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all three of you for coming here today and testifying. We've got a quick comment from Representative Smith, and then Glenn Kolb, Vicki Abney, and John Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wanted to say something in the changeover. A question that's on my mind is why we want to get rid of the Oregon permit rather than improve, tighten, or enforce. If the challenge we have is the challenge we have with permit holders or non-permit holders, and the Oregon permit holders and the people and among the permit holders where there is a problem, is that because there is no way to make a permitting process in Oregon good, or is because we need to change it somehow? So I'm still wrestling with that.
Thank you. In any order.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. We are in support of Senate Bill 391A. I mean, there's been some great discussion, we think, today on both sides. Principally, you know, our concern is that we just don't see that there should be private ownership of captive wild and exotic animals. Unfortunately, in the veterinary profession, we see more often than not the animals just are not cared for, so concerns about animal welfare, their health and well-being, potential for serious injury, and zoonotic diseases. We did talk about that a little bit, but our concern is that while there are people who may be capable of caring for some of these animals, more often they are unable to care for them. And their lack of knowledge about behavioral traits, social needs, proper nutrition, which is seen in the veterinary profession of exotic animals, leads to inadvertent neglect and abuse. And that kind of compromising of welfare of animals just is not right. And so we do support this bill.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Chairman Cannon and the committee, I'm Vicki Abney from Tillamook County, and I just came over today to ask in support of SB 391 without amendments to it for the small cats. I've just been sitting here thinking about this, something no one's really mentioned. I'm a Floridian, and in Florida, people are turning snakes loose. Have anybody seen that? And they're eating every native animal in the Everglades because the pythons have grown, and they're just pets that people are turning loose. And that's what happens with these exotics. If they get turned loose in a place where they are warm and breed and grow and are great. And so that's just another example. The Everglades is in a terrible state right now. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Kennan, members of the committee, my name is John Turner. I'm the Region 1 representative for the Feline Conservation Federation. The FCF is an international organization pioneering exotic feline husbandry for over 50 years. Our members include educators, breeders, sanctuaries, professional conservationists, and owners. The FCF urges you to either vote against 391 or vote for the A2 amendments. By the way, the A2 amendments would put our laws in concurrence with what was passed in Washington. There was some talk about how a number of states have laws on these animals. Washington's exempts the smaller animals, just like the A2 amendments would do. You've heard from the opposition that exotic animals are this grave dangerous to us all, but I can tell you that this is just simply wrong. Attached to my testimony are statistics on the dangers, and there are some dangers, but if you look at the everyday dangers that face us, like driving down the street, those are much greater danger to us than what's posed by exotic animals. And you've heard the stories, and we've heard them year after year for the last three sessions, of the escaped alligator, heard that again and again, the capuchin that jumped on somebody's head, and this new one where this monkey scratched someone. Didn't bite them, it scratched them here in Salem. I'm sure that's going to be added to the list if this comes up next year. These are actually examples of why we don't need this bill and why these animals are safe. In all these years, these are the examples that we've had. A monkey scratches someone. It lands on somebody's head. If anything happens with an exotic, it's top billing in the newspapers. In the Statesman Journal, it exclaimed, "Monkey involved in attack," on the front page. But in the rest of it, it talked about murders, robberies, drugs, two pedestrian deaths buried in the other end of the page. So something happens with an exotic, it's big news. Some people paint exotic animals as a danger faced by emergency services, but tell me, is gobbled up by a tiger on the list of dangers faced by policemen and firemen? How about gobbled up by a 4-pound Jeffrey cat? Is that one of the leading causes of injury for police and fire? So certainly the folks who do respond to the few incidents will have some great stories to tell, but is that the worst thing they're really going to face? And if more training is needed, the FCF and some of the people who deal with primates, we can speak with these folks. There are people in our organizations who have tremendous knowledge, rivaled by none, and can help out in some of these areas if more training is needed. One question that I think Representative Bentz brought up was...
And your time is up, so this will need to be your very last point.
Okay, well, a lot of more points, but hopefully I encourage you to read the testimony that I submitted. I know you have busy schedules. I'd just like to make two more points. Exotic ownership is part of species preservation. We're a tremendous component of it, which gets overlooked. And, Please read my testimony.
Thank you for providing written testimony, and we will take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear from our last couple of folks signed up to testify on this bill. I think it's Kat Malstead and Jim Welsh. I saw Jim in here earlier. Go ahead.
I think I need to remember to breathe.
You'll do fine.
Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Kat Malstead, and I'm the owner of Wolf Dancer Creek Farm and a member of Wolf Dog Rescue Resources, board member of National Wolf Dog Alliance, member of Phoenix Exotics, a member of Rick Sano, and a contributor of Wolf Dog Magazine. I'm also a registered member of Certified National Naturally Grown. I'm an organic farmer in Estacada. I'm speaking here today in opposition to SB 391. Sorry. I've been told that I needn't worry about this bill, that wolf dogs are not on the list of banned species. They are, as they should be, listed as Canis lupus familiaris. But I find myself sitting here before you with my heart in my hands, terrified. And I think of clergyman Martin Niemöller's famous speech in Germany, they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for me, but by that time there was no one left to speak. So, among the arguments that in support of this bill are concerns for the public safety and health, I would like to ask this legislation where responsible private owners of any animal of puts the public at risk. If there's a problem at all, it lies with the fact that the common sense laws that Oregon currently abides by are being laid to the wayside. It lies with irresponsible animal owners. So why are we attempting to legislate and punitively punish all animal owners? Is it just because so-called exotic animal owners are different? Isn't that profiling in nature? I lost an endangered domestic duck the other day to one of my neighbor dog's attacks while running at large. Why don't we enforce our current excellent laws rather than effectively trying to ban all animal ownership? It wasn't my next door neighbor's lion or tiger that killed my duck. It was my irresponsible neighbor who let his pet run loose. The people who sponsored these bills, the Humane Society of the United States, have stated in plain English that their ultimate goal is the abolishment of animal ownership. This is an animal rights organization. It is not an animal welfare organization. They said, in their own words, we have no ethical obligation to preserve the different breeds of livestock produced through selective breeding, one generation and out. We have no problem with the extinction of domestic animals. They are a creation of human selective breeding. This is 1993 from Wayne Pissell, who is now the president of the HSUS.
And if you would finish up, please.
What?
I'm sorry, your time is up. I've been limiting folks to 3 minutes.
So I have no doubts in my heart at all that every one of you is attempting to do your very best to protect animals and to protect the public's safety and health, but I believe that you're being manipulated by a very slick and extreme will. We already have really, really good laws on the books, and it says, can I just, oh, I'm so nervous.
If you have written testimony that you could submit,
I did,
that would be great.
Already. It's the policy of this state that regulation place no more burden upon the keepers of exotic animals than it is required to accomplish the purposes expressed in that section. And so please oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Welsh.
Chair Cannon and committee members, Jim Welsh with Oregon Cattlemen. The only interest we have in this is Section 1. Where there is the definition, and you've excluded the wolf, which is fine by us, as of May 4th, with the delisting, it would be better the wolf in Oregon. Our membership has finally decided that it will be a game animal in the state of Oregon. So that would be have to be taken up by the Fish and Wildlife. So that's the only interest we have, and as it is in the bill, it's fine. So,
thank you. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
With that, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill. Got to get out of that habit. Senate Bill 391A. And let's see. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. And we have five folks signed up to testify. I wonder if we can do this in about 10 minutes. Gail Shibley and Greg Pettit with Beth Myers, Jerry Schmidt, and Peggy Lynch on deck. We'll start with two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of Environmental Public Health for the State of Oregon and the Department of Human Services. I won't go through my written testimony. You do have it there. Senate Bill 739A engrossed is the product of good negotiated agreement, discussion and agreement earlier this session over in the other chamber to deal with an issue that we are very concerned about from a human health standpoint. The bill does three things. One, it adds arsenic to be the third of an existing two contaminants that are required to be tested for when sellers of real property who have a domestic well are currently required to test for nitrates and total coliforms. This would add arsenic. Happy to share with you about why we're concerned about arsenic, but in the interest of time, I'll go on and explain that the second thing that Bill does is say don't only share those test results with the Department of Human Services, with Public Health, which is current statute, but also share those with the buyers of the property, and you have 3 months to do that. Again, that was part of an agreement with the Association of Realtors, and they are fine with the bill. I really appreciate their engagement and effort on this behalf. The third thing that Bill does also is part of this agreement, and it provides some very needed flexibility to identify and intervene when we have specific areas of so-called hot spots where we may have a particular contaminant in a particular area only, and we are concerned from a public health standpoint that perhaps for example, a TCE plume is migrating in a certain direction and a certain velocity, and is there unknown exposure occurring that with this information we could intervene with our partners, the local health departments, and make sure that people are kept safe. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, but if I could just turn it over to my colleague at Department of Environmental Quality.
Great. Thanks, Gail. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I am Greg Pettit, the Administrator of the Laboratory and Environmental Assessment Division at the Department of Environmental Quality. I've submitted written testimony. I'm going to summarize my comments here for the sake of time, try to hit the high points. In Oregon, there are 600,000 residents who get their drinking water from private wells. These wells are not regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the only testing requirement that exists for these wells is the real estate transaction testing requirement. Many of these well owners are simply unaware that contaminants in these wells may pose a risk to their health. The addition of arsenic to the real estate transaction well testing requirement would provide these prospective well owners with important information that they could then use to take proper precautions to protect their health from the unknowing exposure to the carcinogen arsenic. Groundwater quality assessments that have been conducted by DEQ have found that the private wells are the wells that are the most vulnerable to contamination. And the contaminants are often found at concentrations that do pose public health risk. The most common contaminants are pesticides, nitrates, and arsenic. The pesticides and nitrates are human-caused contaminants. The arsenic, in most cases, is thought to be naturally occurring, but not always. I've attached a map to my testimony, Figure 1. It shows the location of wells that we've tested, and the red dots are the locations of wells that exceed the arsenic standard of 10 parts per billion. And you can see by looking at the map that while high arsenic concentrations occur most commonly east of the Cascades, there are pockets of high arsenic groundwater throughout the state. While the primary benefit of this bill would be public health protection, adding arsenic to the real estate transaction testing requirements would also significantly contribute to our overall understanding of groundwater quality conditions within Oregon. The second map that I've attached is Figure 2. It shows the results, the nitrate concentrations that we've acquired through the real estate testing program. The red dots on this map are locations of wells that were sampled through the real estate testing program that had concentrations in excess of the drinking water standard of 10 parts per million for nitrate. And over time, through this program, enough data is collected to generate a fairly good understanding of groundwater quality conditions in Oregon. In this case, we'd be adding arsenic to our understanding. And this information can then be used by the Department of Human Services to target outreach and public education efforts with the goal that the owners of these wells in these areas would be able to take the proper precautions to protect themselves, again, from the unknown exposure to arsenic. So, in summary, the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Human Services work collaboratively on drinking water and groundwater issues towards a common goal of protecting beneficial uses and public health. And our monitoring data strongly supports the need for this bill because of the widespread prevalence of high arsenic throughout the state. And in most cases, we find that the well owners are unaware of this. I think part of this issue is because people are concerned about their well water quality when they can smell or taste something. But most of these contaminants concerned have no odor, no smell, no taste. And so they think their water is fine, but in fact they might be contaminated. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Let's see if there are any quick questions from the committee. Seeing none, you're both excused. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do note that the bill is posted for a possible work session. I encourage you to take advantage of the opportunity today to move the bill. Thank you.
So noted. Come on up. Yeah, the three of you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I've submitted written testimony, so I will make it very quick as well, and I appreciate Ms. Shibley's last comment. I certainly hope that you're encouraged to go ahead and move this bill. The League has been involved in water issues for a long time, and we serve on the Drinking Water Advisory Committee. We've recently been studying water, and local leagues have particularly expressed concern related to exempt residential wells. Recent testimony by the Water Resources Department state that we have approximately 230,000 exempt wells in Oregon and that 3,800 new wells are drilled each year, of which 500 are drilled in groundwater administrative areas. Since the realtors have agreed to the bill, I'm not going to get into the rest of it, but we urge your support for this bill to inform potential buyers of testing results related to nitrates, total coliform, and arsenic. And by the way, they are not currently told. They're submitted to the state, but right now, even the other two matters are not given to the potential buyers. So we're pleased with this bill. We urge your support, and we think it's good for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Beth Myers. I own and operate an environmental testing lab here in Salem for 30 years, and I'll try to be very brief, too. In 1990, they started the coliform and nitrate rule for home sales. So we're 19 years later, and we're adding one. There was some concern in the other part about adding a lot of extra tests, but this is just one more. We've compiled some results of the private, not our public water supplies, but the public testing that is very random since last July, and we had 11% of the random tests that came into our lab in the last year were over the maximum suggested or allowed for EPA for public drinking water. So we had people that were potentially very impacted by high levels of arsenic and did not have any idea. As Greg Pettit said, it's colorless, it's odorless, it's tasteless, it leaves no stain. You don't know you have it unless you test for it. So it is a growing concern. For years, Oregon has acted like we had no problem with arsenic, and that's because we had no data. So we were kind of naive. And now, as we know more, it's important that we get this out to the public, in my mind. The other thing that's of great concern to me is, as we hear the stories of people coming into the laboratory, our medical community in Oregon doesn't know about arsenic either. So we have people who have bladder cancer, colon cancer, that are impacted by the water in their well and have no idea, and the medical doctors don't know to have the testing done either. And juxtapose that with a friend of mine in Florida 2 months ago who was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and her doctor immediately said, please go have your water tested. And so she was treated immediately. Her water source changed. That would not probably happen in Oregon because there is no link that the doctors know about arsenic and the cancers here. And I would, if we do this kind of program, I know that I would like to see a public information sent out to the medical community to make that link. The other issues I have with arsenic as a long-term environmental lab is we also use this water that is potentially high in arsenic for organic farming. And there's implications there, as well as our livestock drinking this. And then we butcher them, and then it goes out to the public in that manner. So those are other issues we have, too.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cherry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. If we could wave a magic wand from my standpoint, what I would like to see is further testing, more regulatory insight to the well owners, what possibilities lay out there. For instance, most folks will test once and then never test again. So if there is some way that the health division could come up with a informational flyer about how to conduct proper tests, what things to test for, I would sure that my group would be more than happy to disseminate that information when they go to the potential client for drilling a well. Arsenic, as I mentioned before, it's present. It's a natural occurring element. It can occur in three different forms. It makes a difference how you treat it and what form it's in. Some of it's rather sophisticated. Some of it you can do with an RO unit, a reverse osmosis unit. Others you have to use an ion exchange. I guess I'd like to summarize that if, in fact, you folks move this bill forward, I would urge you to direct the Health Division to write some rules on how samples are collected, when they're collected, so that we have a standardized procedures about how we proceed with collecting this data, because the data is very valuable. And, for instance, in the drilling process, what happens is that that naturally occurring arsenic that's in the formations will get ground up into the well, in the well cuttings. So at some point, that well needs to be purged, the cuttings removed, so that you don't get a false read with arsenic. So it would be helpful if the Health Division actually set down some formats about when and where and how to construct a test so that we can get some very valuable data from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry. Some questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if we know how many transactions are going to result in this test each year. I should have probably asked that question of Director Shibley. I guess we'll find out.
Gail?
Gail Shibley again. Representative Benson, I appreciate the question. I attempted to provide you the information that you requested in the form of a memo that I believe you have there. And the last line there, I think, shows that from 1989 to 2008, DHS received 21,981 submissions representing data from 18,688 individual properties. The mean value then for on an annual basis is 982 sample submissions per year. So, does that answer your question?
Follow-up. So about 1,000 transactions a year, is that what we would anticipate would be subjected to the additional $20 to $40 fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, we don't have any other basis on which to identify any other number. We do, and you notice there in the memo, it's quite clear that we are we do recognize that we are receiving, surely we are receiving less than 100% of the transactions. We have no way of knowing how many there are. That information simply is not compiled anywhere on a state basis.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And thank you for your testimony. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739A. And, Gail, sorry to disappoint. I think we're close, but I think the comfort level of several members of the committee would be higher with just another couple of days and perhaps a couple of conversations. So encourage you to have those, and I will too. I do intend to move this bill forward. I think it's a good bill. I think we need to do it. And we will see this in work session soon, but hopefully with even greater level of comfort from the full committee. With that, though, I am going to open work session on how are we going to do this. Director Peterson, you've hung out here for a while, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 105, knowing that we've had some conversations about that, and perhaps you would come up and talk, share your perspective on that bill. If you want to address any of the others, we can open that up as them up as well.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and I think we could start with 105, and certainly Andy Ginsberg, our air administrator, is here for the other bills. I could talk about that. So I appreciate the invitation. And in work session, you asked me to generally talk about 105, which is to increase the penalties for certain maximum penalties for violations of certain environmental laws. And so what I thought I would do is just, number one, when I listened to the testimony, there seemed to be some confusion about where enforcement fits into the whole scheme of things and where these particular penalties would reside. If that would be okay, I can talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
And then lead up to what I think the importance of passing this this bill is. First of all, I'm going to start out by saying the state has invested a huge amount of money in compliance with environmental laws, not just the regulatory agencies, but businesses, communities, and individuals put in a lot of money to protect the environment by putting pollution control equipment in and putting equipment in that is intended to comply with environmental laws. The state agencies like DEQ, in particular DEQ, has the responsibility for ensuring that environmental laws and regulations are met. And we do that by creating rules. We implement the Federal Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Clean Air Act, Hazardous Substance Control Act, and so forth. And so we write the rules that that will ensure compliance. Then we have the responsibility of giving the authority, if you will, or the permission for those that have to comply by writing permits, by issuing certificates, or whatever the case may be. By count, I think we have about close to 30,000 touch points in this state in terms of our touch point with people that have to comply with environmental laws. And so we have a lot of integration with people that that do have to comply to protect Oregon's environment. And how do we do that? We write permits and other things, as I said. But most importantly, I think, for Oregon DEQ, we have decentralized our organization. We put people out in the field to be close to the people that we regulate, to be close to the people that care about who we're regulating, and be close to the natural environment that we're regulating. So we're there not only to be close to that community, but to they're the people that write the permits that interface with the people that we work with. With that said, the responsibility is a shared one in some cases, whereby we will review information that's submitted to us to see if there's compliance. We will also do inspections, go out and look at facilities to determine if they're in compliance, and we'll also respond to complaints or spills that are reported to us. And so we have a pretty strong network that's in there to help ensure that there is compliance. Another aspect of the people that we have out in the field is to provide technical information and support to help people comply with the laws that may be complicated for them to do so. So that's all the sort of network of how DEQ operates. Now, when we see a violation of a law, we have a several-stage approach that goes to that. Number one is we will be either notified or we'll see that paper violation. And the people in the field using a matrix, and I'll speak to that in just one second, will actually determine the nature of that violation. And if it's not serious, we'll issue a warning letter. They'll warn people that they are in noncompliance and they have to return to compliance. So that's one thing that happens. The next level up that happens is if the nature of the violation is serious enough that it requires us to look to assessing a penalty, we'll refer that particular violation to for informal enforcement action. That formal enforcement action takes the form of an assessed civil penalty and potentially an order to correct the violation. Once we assess that civil penalty, there's more opportunity that's remaining there. One is that those that we assess the penalty for that may disagree with us can have an informal meeting with the department to determine if the facts are right and correct, and some adjustments can be made there. If we go forward with the penalty assessment, that the people that have violated can actually contest that or appeal that through the administrative rules process and administrative judge. If they don't like that, they can appeal it further to our Environmental Quality Commission. So I just want you to understand there's a whole layer of compliance work that goes on before we actually get to a formal enforcement. I think, Chair Cannon, you had mentioned earlier as you were wondering about the number of formal enforcement cases seemingly low. I'm not going to disagree with you, but I think it's in line certainly with our neighbors to the north in Washington about the numbers that they issue. But I would say the network of what we do to ensure and work on compliance really does not lead us to that particular place in a lot of cases. Now,
just yep. To be clear, because I want to make sure I have the right number right. In my head, I think we heard roughly 200
that's correct.
Penalties. Assessed a
per year.
And that's you know, out of, I think you said 30,000 touch points, which,
right.
You know, take all shapes and sizes.
That's correct.
30,000 interactions
right.
That people are having with DEQ in a regulatory right. Setting, 200 of which result in penalties.
Okay. Informal enforcement action.
Informal
I mean,
enforcement
one,
action.
You might think of a penalty in a number of different ways. For instance, we see 500,000 people drive through vehicle test centers a year, and those that don't pass have to go out spend money to fix their car before they can get a license. I mean, that's not formal enforcement,
right.
But
right.
You can equate it to an enforcement action. So how we get to the number is we have a pretty elaborate matrix system I think we forwarded to the committee that was through a rulemaking process that was done in 2006 that tailors the penalty to the seriousness of the violation, mitigating factors, and all that sort of thing. So I'm not going to get into that detail. Now, what's important for us, DEQ, and the recommendation that you pass 105 is that this deterrence effect for the maximum penalty. I think in the letter that we provided to you at the request, I think it was Representative Bentz that asked for that. How many? What's the number of people that are impacted by that 10,000? I think over the last 5 years, there's 22 individual cases that were capped at the 10,000 thing. We couldn't go above that. So that gives you an idea. There's not a lot that would be affected by this. But for me and for DQ, the important things is the deterrence. When you have a violation that is so serious that people can make a decision whether or not they invest or not, the cost consequences are serious, not only from the response and the state investment to respond to something that might be serious, but also to the environmental damage that might or could occur. So from my view, if there's a deterrence factor by raising this and we never have to use it because of that deterrence factor, that's an important statement. I can give you three quick examples of things that might fall into that category. One is if we have a major spill in the state where something spills into the environment, into water, say an oil or a hazardous material spill into the waters of the state. And it's a one-day event, massive fish kill, all the sorts of things that go in that. We're capped at the $10,000 limit there by an assessment. Another factor that might be considered is an entity that has a large amount of material that they have to manage or pollution control material that they manage that could result in a release through their emission source or their discharge source in such a way that it really does a lot of harm and damage and it's over one day. That would be capped at $10,000. Another example that I think that our Mr. Carlo, who was here before, gave where someone may choose to assemble a number of building materials or whatever and from a whole bunch of different places in put it on fire and cause a lot of environmental damage that way. And that could actually avoid a lot of cost for them personally that it might cost to properly dispose of that material. It might be less expensive. $10,000 might be less expensive than to properly dispose of that material. So I think there's examples out there whereby people could avoid the cost of actual compliance by paying a spill. My view is that this deterrence effect here is real, it's significant, and if it can avoid some things, it really makes a big difference. And my hope is that we'd never have to impose that kind of penalty on people, but having it there might avoid that.
And the base penalty that's used in the formula doesn't change under this bill, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Any questions for the director? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talk about a $10,000 cap.
Mm-hmm.
Is this past tense or future tense or the product of the bill here?
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, the current maximum is $10,000, and so the bill proposes to raise it in four categories to $25,000 in air violations, water violations, hazardous waste violations, and up to $100,000 in oil spill. The current level in oil spills is $20,000. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
I seem to have some correspondence follow-up over the years from your agency, from constituents in my area where the charge was significantly mm-hmm. greater than $10,000.
Right. Representative Jensen, sorry for the misconfusion. This is per day of violations. So someone that might have a long-term violation over many, many, many days, it could pile up, or if they have multiple different media violations.
Okay.
So it's per day.
Per day.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you for those questions. Representative Boone?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And what do you do with the money that you get from the fines?
Representative Cannon, Representative Boone, thank you for the question. Almost all of the fines go to general fund. There's a couple of minor exemptions. One is the underground storage tank fine goes back to the program, and some aspect of the spill release fine goes back to the department. But pretty much a huge percentage of it goes to general fund.
I know in the past, and maybe it is a function of the courts to do this, but I know sometimes where fines have been given and they've been designated to mitigate the problem that the fine was charged for. Do you ever do anything like that, or can you?
Yes, Representative Cannon, Representative Boone, we have a policy. It's called a supplemental environmental project whereby if someone's fined, say, X amount, I'll just give a number, say $100,000, they can propose to 80% of that fine, they can propose what's called a supplemental environmental project, which is an environmental project that has nothing to do with the violation. It's something that benefits benefits the environment, and it's not something that's required by law. So we have the option for folks to do that.
Okay, and mm-hmm. is there any attempt to fix what the problem is with that fine?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, as far as the discharge, the civil penalty and order can take on the form of an order whereby if there is a problem that's occurring, we, in addition to the civil penalty, we can order the entity to correct the problem that occurs. So that's usually part of it as well.
Representative Bentz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my concern has been that the penalty authority that the, by the way, I want to preface my remarks by saying that I think the folks that DEQ has out in the field are excellent, and I think they've done very good work. And when I've worked with them, they've been to a person quality folks. It seems to me, though, that the $10,000 per day of violation device is more than adequate. And I think am I correct in saying that you have to search to find a situation that would, in fact, be over in one day? Because it seems to me that most of those things I've been involved with continue on until someone finally goes and cleans them up, and thus the accrual is huge. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, the $25,000 seems to me to be beyond what you folks need to do the good job you've been doing. Mm-hmm. So I don't have your letter. It may be here in my papers. I just haven't been able to find it. But I guess I need to hear the absolute clearest statement from you of the exact situation where you did not have the authority you needed to do your job.
Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz. Well, first of all, I think we have the authority to do our job. My point is here is the deterrence effect that might have avoided a problem from occurring. So the list that was provided in here were 22 types of violations that occurred over the 5 years that were capped at the $10,000 per day, and they ranged from major spills into waterways to mishandling of hazardous waste. I'm sorry, missed the question.
If it's spilled in the waterway, the situation continues longer than one day. I don't know why it would have been capped.
Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, not always the case.
A follow-up, Chair? Yep. I noticed in reviewing the statute, in fact, it says that there's a violation for the water and not cleaning it up. So I'm not quite – do you call out in your memo exactly the case that prevented you from using the second type of authority you would have for a spill in the water?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, maybe I'm not fully understanding the question. If there is multiple day violations, we would have applied that. And I don't know if I called out in each one of these individually whether there's multiple violations associated with that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I must apologize. I have an appointment at the Speaker's office, which I now have to leave for, but I'm very sad to have to leave because I would like to continue the even though I know we're out of time.
And we may move to a motion on this bill. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You may move to one in the next few minutes.
In the next few minutes, yeah. I'd like to.
I wait one more minute. One more minute. How do you think?
Well, let's see how it goes. I mean, I don't presume to know the outcome of the motion or the discussion. But why don't we get the motion since we are under this timeline and it is almost 5 o'clock, and see if there's further discussion after we get the motion from Representative Smith.
Can I say something before I make the motion, just out of conscience?
Sure.
All right. So for me, the fact that there haven't been penalty increases for 25 years, I must admit, is persuasive to me. I am not yet persuaded by the set of criteria we use to set our levels. They seem roughly arbitrary. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're perfect and wonderful. As we go forward, you know, I am still persuaded 25 years is an awful long time to keep them at the same level. And would love to have a discussion at some point about, you know, what do we see about the proper deterrence level? How can we do some math to make sure we feel like we've gotten it right? I'm going to say that before I made a motion rather than after.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, that said, I do move Senate Bill 105A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 105A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Well, seeing none, we'll see how it goes. Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
No.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. The motion carries, and Senate Bill 105A will move to the floor. Unless anybody is dying to carry the bill. I will carry it. And with that, close the work session on Senate Bill 105A. And members, we do have a couple of others today. We have, however, lost our district, what is it, 60 representative. So I think we will carry these over. Can we carry over the work session?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do that. Let's carry over the work session on Senate Bill 102 and on Senate Bill 104. And with that, close the hearing on for the Environment Water Committee.